Hello, lovely listeners. Welcome back to another episode of Coffee and Crime, a true crime podcast. If you're new here, hey, how you doing? My name is Lisa Marie, and each week I sit down with a cup of coffee and I tell you all about some true crime shenanigans. However, this week is the second part to the story about the Mr. Asia drug syndicate. So if you are tuning in for the first time, I do recommend going back two episodes ago to part one, and so that you can be all caught up. Or don't, completely up to you. I just feel like it'd be give you the best experience with coffee and crime to have part one under your belt. Now, a few admin things. I am going to be changing my days of release. So I usually release an episode on a Saturday evening at 8 p.m. New Zealand Standard Time. However, I'm just going to bump it over 24 hours. So instead of a Saturday, it'll be a Sunday evening at 8 p.m. New Zealand time. That means that when you wake up Monday morning, fresh as a bunny, fresh as a daisy, fresh as a bunny, fresh as a daisy, ready to go to work, there'll be an episode sitting there waiting for you. But this is just because, you know, I work full time throughout the week. I am a single mom, life gets busy. So I've decided, you know what, I'll just give myself an extra day in the week to get everything ready so I'm not rushing around. And sometimes, you know, I've got plans on Saturday nights and I don't want to have to stress about making sure the episode goes out. So, yes, we are changing over to a Sunday. And the other admin thing is I'm going to be pumping the brakes on YouTube for a while. I just don't have the correct equipment to make the YouTube process easy. And I've had quite a few hiccups just about every week. I've had hiccups with YouTube, so I'm not really enjoying the experience and I'm not going to continue with something that I'm not enjoying. So YouTube is not gone forever. There is one more episode that I will put up, and that was from last week's case of the Bubble and Squeak. But yeah, I'm just going to press pause on YouTube for now. Before we get into today's case, since we are covering a Aotearoa New Zealand case, essentially, I do want to take a moment just to say that anyone who's listening or anyone listening that has family in Auckland, Northland, Hamilton, Waikato, Bay of Plenty, Hawke's Bay, anywhere in the North Island, we have just been hit with Cyclone Gabrielle and it's been devastating. We've had a pretty shit week over here in New Zealand, unfortunately, and especially those at the top of the North Island. I mean, there was last week, Auckland was pretty much flooded. And now we've got the cyclone that's just kind of passed us by. There was a big earthquake down in Wellington the other day, which was quite scary. I mean, luckily, no substantial damage. But yeah, New Zealand's in a bit of a weird spot at the moment. So I just want to, you know, take a second to say that anyone who's been affected by the most recent natural disasters, my thoughts and prayers are with you. And I hope that all your loved ones have been able to get in contact with you and are safe. I also want to take a moment to acknowledge the two firefighters that lost their lives as a house collapsed on them. One of them was able to make their way out, but they died in hospital from their injuries a little bit later on. And the other firefighter, unfortunately, wasn't found for a while. Two incredibly brave people serving their community, and unfortunately, their lives were lost. So yeah, I just want to take a moment. Keep New Zealand in your thoughts and prayers, guys. We really would appreciate that. Now, that is all for the intro spiel. I am ready to crack on with this case. I'm so excited for today's episode in, you know, true crime excited fashion. I'm really excited to bring this to you guys. So grab your cup of coffee or whatever caffeinated beverage you need to get through your day. And join me as we continue to learn about the Mr. Asia drug syndicate of Aotearoa, New Zealand. Warning: the following episode contains adult language, discussion on drug use, domestic violence, mutilation, and murder that listeners may find disturbing. This podcast is recommended for listeners 16 years and above. Listener discretion is advised. Right, so quick recap just to refresh our memories. In part one, we started off with meeting Terence Clark, or Terry Clark as we call him, and how he became quite known to the police early on in his life. He was a bit of a wannabe gangster, a bit of a thug, and he became an informant for the police because he was connected to the criminals. And I asked you to remember that he was a snitch for the police, and you'll understand why in a bit. It's something that I wanted you to remember. We also learned that Terry got married and had a couple of children in the early 1960s, but by 1969 he was divorced and incarcerated at Waitako Prison, which is now known as Rimutaka Prison, and fun fact, is 23 minutes away from my house! Yay! Connections! Love that! We met some of the quote-unquote friends that Terry made while in prison, and I won't go through all of them, but the ones that I wanted you to remember were Greg Ollard, Peter Fulcher, and Diamond Jim Shepherd, as they do play quite a substantial role within the syndicate. Now, when Terry was released from prison in 1973, he met Marty Johnston. Before we get into Marty, we kind of wrapped up some things in Terry's timeline, and that was while he was in Waitako Prison, he met and married a woman by the name of Norma Fleet, who was a very heavy heroin user. Now in 1975, Norma died under mysterious circumstances, and though it's never been confirmed nor denied, many believe, including myself, that Terry had a hand in her death. We believe Terry murdered her, okay? Let's just put that. There was a quote that Peter Fulcher, who worked very closely with Terry, and he pretty much said, I'm not confirming it, but yeah, he did it. But anyway, we don't know. Norma was a heavy heroin user. It may have been an accidental overdose, but it was sad on all fronts. And by all accounts, those who knew her said that she was a really cool chick who just unfortunately had a very poor hand in life. Now, Terry did remarry after Norma had another child, but they kind of just split at some point. I don't really know. There's not much about that. But then we met Marty Johnston, and he seemed to be a pretty okay dude. He was classy, well-dressed, a smooth talker. He had a passion for fashion, and he worked in menswear stores, including a shop that was owned by his dad, Brian. Now, while he was working in menswear, he was working alongside a guy called Andrew Mayer. I'm going to remind you this. Andrew and Marty were best friends. Like, I'm going to drill this in. I did it in part one. I'm doing it again. They were best friends, okay? Okay. Now, the two besties, they're, you know, late teens, early 20s, and all they want to do is make money, which, relatable, come on. And so they, instead of doing it, like, the honest way, by working hard, they turned to theft, and this turned into drug dealing. And we actually took a moment to look at the history of marijuana use in New Zealand, and it was really fascinating, and I actually got a lot of good feedback from you guys who said that you really enjoyed that little spiel. Like, it just kind of broke up the episode, and you guys actually really appreciated that, so thank you. I enjoyed it too. I don't think I'd turn into like a history podcast, but I do. It was fun. Anyway, after that, Marty and Andrew, they met Jack Chu, who was a Singaporean ship steward who also smuggled a very strong Thai variety of weed in forms of Buddha sticks in through the Rangitoto Channel, and this is how Marty became a very popular drug dealer. Now, in 1973, this is where the timelines collided. Through Greg Ollard, Marty and Terry met, and they wanted to expand on their drug dealing operation. They decided to cut Jack Chu out and just go to Thailand directly and get the marijuana from the source. And this is when we heard about the cursed voyage of the Brigadoon. I feel like I have to say it in a Scottish voice. The Brigadoon. Now, you don't have to listen to all of part one, but if there's just one part that I can like persuade you to listen to, it's about what happened on this journey. Because it was just a mess. And anything and everything that could go wrong did. And it, oh my goodness, it was hilarious. I was talking to one of my mates who was listening, and she was like texting me as she was listening going, he did what? And this is what happened? Like, shout out Sarah. She's so funny. She always messages me when she's listening to an episode. Love it. But from this cursed voyage, Marty and Terry did make a bucket and a half full of money, like estimating roughly about $3 million, which we also did a lot of maths in part one, I must say. But that was, I think, from memory, about $34 million in today's currency. So it was huge. This was a huge turning point for Marty and Terry realizing that they could go bigger. And bigger they did. They decided that the next step was to import and distribute high-grade Thai uncut heroin. Now, going from marijuana to heroin, if you're using or distributing, it's a big jump. They are completely different types of drugs, both dangerous in different aspects, but it's just like, ugh, don't do drugs, kids. So we ended the episode with the birth of the Mr. Asia Drug Syndicate, and I actually will just say, that's not what they called themselves straight away. They actually just called themselves the organization. Like, super creative. The name Mr. Asia Drug Syndicate came later on, and that's just how, obviously how we know it by now. But that's, yeah, so the birth of the organization, and that looked like Marty moving to Singapore to be connected to the opium warlords within the Golden Triangle. Greg Ollard and his girlfriend Julie Thalman moving to Sydney to head the Australian distribution, or branch, I guess, the Australia branch, and Terry remaining in Auckland to head the New Zealand branch. Diamond Jim Shepherd, who Terry met in Waitsako Prison, was hired as the banker for the group, and he was the one that was moving the money they made into offshore accounts, different investments, properties in the Bay of Islands and Fiji and whatnot. Their friends and associates were moving all over New Zealand and Australia to be distributors, dealers, and couriers. And we were quickly introduced to the idea of a courier. These were young, impressionable females who were able to move about undetected or without suspicion, carrying millions of dollars worth of heroin. That's unreal. Now, authorities in New Zealand were aware of a drug operation, probably not to the extent that it was, let alone what it became. And they were aware of this quite early on, but they just never caught up to Marty. And then he moved to Singapore and, you know, then they were well left behind in the dust. So that's the recap. I can't believe I managed to get all of that into like 7 minutes. Oh my goodness. But yeah, so that's the recap. If you still haven't listened to part one, I do recommend, because we did do deep dives. Like I said, you want to know about what happened on the Brigadoon, you've got to listen to part one. But we're going to go on with part two now. So we are still in 1975. This is a very busy year for Marty and Terry. Norma Fleet, she died. The cursed voyage of the Brigadoon happened, and then they decided about heroin and moving to their new homes, you know, Singapore, Australia, and Auckland, all to get ready for this new venture within the organization of heroin importation. However, things changed very quickly, as in 1975, this is still 1975, they've just moved to their places, ready for this, like I said, ready for this new venture, and Terry got arrested for importing heroin. Like, it's literally his first day on the job. Like, oh my goodness, you know that meme, like, you had one job, bro. And it's like a picture of someone doing something just not quite right. This was Terry. His job was to import heroin into New Zealand, and he got arrested for importing heroin into New Zealand. Oh, God. Now, he was arrested, he was able to make bail, which is something we're going to see quite a lot. It's no surprise, with all the money that the organisation now had readily available, and bail money was chump change to them, which just baffles me. While Terry was awaiting his trial, he decided not only to skip town, but to jump across the Tasman to Australia. Like, skip countries, not towns. So then he's over there, but he's meant to be heading the New Zealand branch, right? So the new plan was, yes, Greg and Julie would stay as the head of the Australian branch. Peter Fulcher would be the head of the New Zealand branch, and Terry would just be kind of like above them. You know, he is second in charge. He's Marty's right-hand man. You know, it made sense for him to kind of go up the chain of command, I suppose. But the shipment process of the, you know, of the heroin kind of changed as well. And from what I could gather, I don't quite understand, and I don't want to understand how drug importation works, but instead of ships going to Australia and New Zealand, instead they would all go to Australia, or, you know, islands near Australia, all to Terry, and then Terry would somewhat distribute it between Greg, and then send the rest over to Peter in New Zealand. And he was able to send it over to New Zealand again using these couriers, young impressionable females, and they would use false bottom suitcases or strap the heroin to their bodies. Now, remembering this is the mid-1970s, border security and customs, they were just not what they are today. You know, there were no sniffer dogs back in the 1970s. Now, it's quite funny. I had a bit of a moment, guys. I'm a very visual learner, right? And I need to see pictures of things to be more confident to talk about it, even if it's something as simple as like a bracelet. You know, I just want to look at a photo of it just to be more confident to talk about it. I don't know, it's just me. Cool. So I was Googling a picture of a false bottom suitcase, and then I realized I had all these other tabs open, and they were like butter sticks, marijuana, heroin, drug importation, like all these things, and I was like, oh no. I've probably like pinged up on the New Zealand police database, which it's quite problematic because I work for the New Zealand police. So Anna, my manager, if you're listening, I'm not a drug lord. I'm a true crime junkie, not a drug junkie. I'm just trying to give a good episode, okay? She's probably going to text me like, you've got a meeting Monday morning. It just made me laugh that I had all these quite problematic tabs open. But yeah, so this is how the couriers were taking heroin in between Australia and New Zealand. Now, Greg and Terry, they were based in Sydney, and they actually struck up quite a beneficial partnership for the organisation. And this was with a permanent buyer of any heroin that came in. Obviously not all of it, but quite a substantial amount. This meant that Terry knew that he would be getting X amount of dollars per shipment because someone was always going to be buying it, right? And this partnership was with Sydney's biggest organized crime operation known as the Double Bay Mob. And this gang had investments in huge yachts, which were able to help with the importation. The Double Bay Mob had paid off many customs officials and even ports to look the other way when yachts came in, right? Just very, very corrupt period of time. What also helped the syndicate take off, alongside having the Double Bay Mob in their pockets, was that a lot of New Zealanders moving to Australia were looking to make a quick buck, and they knew Greg, or they knew Terry, or they knew the people that were associated with them, and so they were able to join the organisation by becoming distributors or dealers. However, there seemed to be a somewhat intense recruitment process with this. If you wanted to be a dealer or distributor, Terry needed to make sure you weren't a snitch. Now, this is going to slowly tie in to why I asked you to remember that Terry was a snitch for the police in his early years, because in his adult years, Terry hates snitches. And I just think it's funny because he was one. Like, could he be any more hypocritical? Channeling my inner Chandler. Could he be any more hypocritical? But this did give Terry somewhat an advantage, having been an informant, because he knows what to look for. And essentially, I think he just wanted to beat the snitch out of people. You know what I mean? He loved being the bad guy in this good guy, bad guy routine that him and Greg would have when they were taking on new recruits. So over the next couple of years, having the Double Bay Mob and also all these new migrants coming into Australia from New Zealand, they were able to grow to be one of the biggest drug operations that came out of like one of the smallest countries. Oh, and don't get me wrong, the spoils of the drug importation life, these guys were making millions upon millions of dollars, like unlike anyone has ever seen. And I can't even fathom that, you know what I mean? I can't imagine being that rich. Isn't that sad? I can't even imagine what all that money would look like if you were to put it in a pile. That's how like poor and low class I am. But I mean, these guys were having, you know, Dom Perignon champagne. They were sleeping with beautiful women, going to the best restaurants, like anything they wanted. They were having tailored suits made, like handmade tailored suits. They were flaunting their wealth. And because the New South Wales, which is where Sydney is, was so corrupt. They literally could walk around with white powdered noses at the law and they were untouchable. It was actually said later by a judge that the New South Wales police could be bought for the price of a hamburger. Like he said, it was just so easy to buy off police, which is ridiculous. However, there were some issues that started to arise within the organisation, and these were things such as STDs and other health problems. Now, I will get into some health issues later on in the episode, but, you know, these things were starting to become quite prevalent, and the top dogs, they were passing around women. They were also passing around the same instruments to use drugs, so it was, even though it may have looked glamorous on the outside with all the money and the cars and the boats and the suits, behind the scenes, it was a very dirty and a very dangerous lifestyle. But that wasn't the only type of issues that were going on. With lots of people now getting involved and spreading all over Australia and New Zealand, it became quite hard to keep track of all the dealers and the deals that they were doing. Now, Australia is huge, and someone in Sydney might not know what's going on in Perth. And even New Zealand, which is nowhere near as big, if you're in Auckland, it's very hard to keep track of someone who's in Wellington or further yet Christchurch in the South Island. The way, from what, again, I'm not really too well versed on drug importation or drug dealing, but from what I gathered, the organisation would set up one or two distributors in each major town or city, and then they would keep track of a number of dealers within the cities. Then the distributors would have to communicate with Peter Fulcher in Auckland or Greg and Julie in Sydney, and then they would communicate with Terry. But, you know, this is the 70s. They don't have the technology to send an instant text or ping a location on someone at any given point. Like, there was a whole process to it. So it was slow, and if anything was going wrong, I mean, let's be honest, you're hiring people to deal drugs for you. I don't imagine all of them are upstanding citizens or the most honest of people. And slowly but surely, there seemed to be rip-offs and deals gone bad and, you know, like heroin just being given out freely. And that started to happen over the years within the organisation. And I mean, a low-level drug dealer might not think anything of it. Oh yeah, I'm just going to give my mates some heroin. They don't have to pay mates rates, whatever, but it does trickle back up to the top. Now, Terry would not stand for any of this, and he would be the first to enforce and maintain discipline within the organisation. Now, he couldn't just exactly waltz back in to New Zealand because he had skipped bail in 1975, so if he heard of anyone playing up in New Zealand, he would order a hit. He would take a contract and order a hitman to go and take them out. He would also use fear tactics, like, to the max, to keep everyone in line. There was an alleged incident with one dealer that Terry thought that was holding out on him, and allegedly, Terry took this dealer out into a field, held a gun to his head, and allegedly said, quote, "I'm going to take out what you owe me in flesh. If you cop it, you will live, but if you don't, I will kill you," end quote. Terry, as we'll come to find out, takes pleasure in these fear tactics, you know, cat and mouse, you know, that type of power dynamic. He had a huge ego. Now, a few dealers actually started going quote-unquote missing or actually just winding up dead with these rip-offs and dirty deals happening, and tensions between everyone was rising. Fingers were being pointed, blame was being thrown around, and the use of drugs, since they were all heavy drug users, didn't help anyone's anxiety or paranoia. And in 1977, Greg Ollard and his girlfriend Julie Thelman, who were the head of the Australian branch, they decided it was time to pack it in. Greg was only ever in this organisation for the money, and he always made that quite clear. It wasn't the access to the drugs or the lavish lifestyle of having women, because he was in a serious relationship. Greg once said to a friend of his, quote, "I've got $400,000 in cash now, and when I get to $1 million, I'm going to quit," end quote. So it seemed that Greg made his financial goal and decided to cash in his share of the business. However, it seemed that leaving this operation wouldn't be as smooth as Greg would have thought. In November of 1977, after a, quote, "fiery meeting," end quote, with several top operatives, Greg and Julie vanished. Did they disappear into society? Let's just put a pin in this mystery for now. So after Greg, quote-unquote, left the organization, Terry for a short time fully took the responsibility of his own role plus heading the Australian distribution. Whereas, like, before he was higher up and now he had to do a bit more of the grunt work, so to speak. Like, he was always involved and heavily involved, don't get me wrong, but now he had to do more of the lower level jobs that Greg and Julie were doing. So with Terry's increase in responsibility, he seemed to ramp up his intake of distributors, dealers and couriers, and this included one Alison Raywin Dine. Now, this is a name I want you to remember. Alison was a kindergarten teacher from Rotorua who moved to Australia, and when she met Terry Clark, Cupid struck and she was absolutely infatuated with him. And unfortunately, Raywin was one of many beautiful young girls whose lives changed after meeting Terry, not exactly in the best of ways. Now, Terry was also taken with Alison as well, and he did actually have a romantic relationship with her, whereas the other women were more or less flings. Alison became Terry's lover and top drug courier. She would do anything to keep Terry happy. She would also in turn bring her girlfriends into the business, and they loved the high life. They were getting top quality drugs, sex, and money thrown at them. These girls, Alison included, would have to make drug runs from Fiji as some of the heroin was being imported there from Thailand, so they would essentially be getting paid to go on a vacation. You know, they would go over, they would pose as holiday makers or bachelorettes, and they would wear their slinky bikinis and their not very many clothes, and they would be able to go around without bringing suspicion to them, because that's what you do in Fiji. You go and you have a holiday and you go and get a suntan and you lay on the beach, and that's what these girls were doing. And then they were able to, you know, leave Fiji with millions of dollars worth of heroin right under the officials' noses. Now, if any of them did run into any trouble, Terry pretty much had a hotline straight to law enforcement. He'd call up and he'd say, like, let her go, she's one of mine. And Alison or one of her gal pals would be on their merry way. However, women weren't exactly safe from Terry's wrath. He was known to be a womanizer, but also quite a violent abuser. If one of the girls messed up, so was caught gifting away the heroin, or not taking payment, or, you know, not sticking to the rules of the organization, Terry would be the first to put them in their place. He did not care if they were male or female. He was ruthless. In fact, back in 1975, and this is terrible, a Sydney dress designer who was also a courier for the organization, she disappeared on Christmas Eve of 1975, and her body was found tied to a ship's anchor that was in the Sydney harbor. And it was believed that Terry had ordered the hit on her for messing up. Now, I know I haven't actually mentioned that much about Marty in this episode. You know, he is the boss, he is the kingpin, but we don't actually know heaps of what he was doing during this time. He's in Singapore, he's living his best life, he had a two-story luxury apartment, he was a member of the Pan Am's Lifetime Clipper Club, he was wearing French silk shirts and hand-tailored three-piece suits. He's doing what he needs to do, but he was kind of staying out of the spotlight, which is, I suppose, what he wanted. So I know that I haven't mentioned heaps about him, but don't worry, he's there. He's also unbelievably rich. Like, one time he flew first class from Singapore to London, quote, just for the hell of it, end quote. So yeah, don't worry about Marty. He's doing all right. Now, we don't even have the exact numbers of how much the syndicate or the organization was making, but just to give you an idea, Diamond Jim Shepherd, right, on a good week, he was making roughly $100,000 in a week. That's not even close to what I make in a year, right? And $100,000 in 1977 would be close to $800,000 today. And that's what he was making in a freaking week. I can't, like, again, I can't even imagine having that kind of money. That's how poor I am. Now, the bill for Auckland's import alone was making roughly $34 million. And again, that would be about $271 million today. Now, this obviously wasn't just sitting in one person's bank account. It had to be distributed, the money. It had to go to the dealers, the couriers, the distributors, law enforcement, custom officials. Everyone had to be paid, right? But the rest was then moved into different accounts and, you know, the offshore accounts, the shares, the investments, all that type of stuff. But it's just unheard of for a small country like New Zealand to generate anything like this. It's just, I can't even wrap my head around it. Terry once made a joke that he couldn't spend the interest he was making off of his money because it was just too much. Can you imagine having too much money? Wouldn't that be nice? I mean, I'd like to do it the honest way, but you know, it wouldn't hurt. But yes, I want to circle back to the tensions that were rising within the operation. In early of 1978, so not long after Greg and Julie, quote unquote, left the organisation, Pommy Harry Lewis, who was only a middle-ranking dealer, but he was someone who had substantial shares in one of Marty's businesses, he and two female couriers were arrested at Sydney Airport on cannabis importation. Now, again, whenever anyone was arrested, they weren't in jail for very long. His bail was set at $5,000 Australian, and let's be honest, that was nothing. That was absolutely nothing to the organization. Like I said, it was chump change. Now, once Harry was out on bail, he skipped town and fled north, and then he vanished. Did he disappear into society with Greg and Julie? Do they have like a cute little apartment together? We're gonna put a pin in this mystery as well. So like I said, after Greg and Julie left the organization and Terry was covering their roles, he did find a replacement quite quickly. In early of 1978, a Kiwi couple now living in Australia, this was Doug and Isabel Wilson. Doug had known Terry from school and had previously been a part of the early days of the cannabis distribution back in Auckland. Well, Doug and his wife Isabel would now become the head of the Australian branch. So Terry could put his feet back up for a little while. He could have his weekends off again. No, obviously Terry is very involved constantly, but he could now, you know, share the load. However, this new role for Doug and Isabel was short-lived. They were living their new lives and they were loving it. They were living in a luxury apartment and they would spend their earnings on fine art, expensive cars and clothes, the best for their pets. They had a couple of dogs, but they too were heavy heroin users, and much like everyone involved, they fell in it hard and they fell in it fast. While awaiting a shipment drop in Brisbane, about 9.5 hours north of Sydney, Doug and Isabel were arrested by police along with some other of the organization's members. Now, even though law enforcement were paid off, this was more or less just the New South Wales police. Brisbane is in Queensland territory, so they were a little bit slower to receive the news. So Doug and Isabel have been arrested. Okay, like this part is insane. So after 3 days of interrogation from Brisbane police, Doug and Isabel sang like a theatre kid watching a musical. Okay, I'm one of these kids, I can say that. They gave Brisbane police the tea and did not hold anything back. They named names, the killers, secrets, plans, how the operation was working, everything. Doug and Isabel told police everything they needed to know about Terry and Marty, and even, okay, get this, even how Marty had hired an inside man that was working, that was working for the Australian Bureau of Narcotics. Oh, they were paying this inside man a salary of $30,000, and this covered his discretion, computer information, and the removal of any information that was stored in relation to the organization. So, like, surely this is it, right? Like, this is the end. The police have everything they need, so they're just going to go and arrest Terry and Marty, and this is going to be it. Well, don't be so silly. I just said that Brisbane police were slower to receive the news, but it did catch up with them. Doug and Isabel weren't given any jail time. No bail set, the police simply dismissed everything they said and sent them on their merry way. No protective custody, no police witness protection, no nothing. And of course, Terry got word of what happened in that interrogation room. In fact, it was later revealed, and this is true fact, it was revealed that Marty paid $250,000 for the interrogation tapes, and they were given to him. So Terry heard Doug and Isabel hand over this treasure chest of information to the police. And what have we learned about Terry? He's mean, he's evil, and he doesn't like snitches. So once again, Doug and Isabel were released and they vanished. Did they too disappear into society with Greg, Julie, and Harry? They're having like a little party in their basement, hiding away from Terry. Well, let's put a pin in the mystery of Doug and Isabel for now. We're going to run out of pins, but it's okay. We're going to unplug them soon. Now, I am being very ominous about these disappearances, and we are going to talk about another one, but I will say that there were bodies piling up that weren't just simple disappearances, and most, if not all, were ordered by Terry, and he would boast about them. I mentioned earlier how he found pleasure in having blood on his hands, right? He loved it. It made him feel like head honcho, big balls man, like he loved it. In fact, at a luncheon that Terry had with the banker, Diamond Jim Shepherd, Terry raved on and on about how he had murdered or had killed at least 6 associates across New Zealand and Australia. Terry was a serial killer, like fact, period. He's been dubbed New Zealand's worst serial killer, and that's because he did actually order other people to do it. He wasn't... Okay, without giving too much away, Terry didn't pull the trigger on a lot of these murders. He would order other people to do it. So he was a serial killer, but he just kind of made sure other people did the dirty work to cover his tracks. Yeah. Now, like raving at a luncheon about murders, he may have been evil, but he wasn't actually that smart. In June of 1978, Terry was arrested whilst at a party in Brisbane and was finally going to be extradited back to New Zealand to face the heroin importation charges that he skipped on back in 1975. So about 3 years later, they caught up with him. However, the organisation were able to pay for the best of the best lawyers, and I mean, most of them were employed by Marty specifically for their organisation. And I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if these lawyers were snorting off the same table as Terry and the other members. Like, everyone is so dodgy back in these days. But Terry had the best lawyer for his heroin importation charges, and he was able to be acquitted of them. So we are now in 1979. Everyone is richy rich and high high on heroin, crack cocaine, and marijuana. After the trial in New Zealand, Terry actually changed his name and all of his, you know, documents, his passport, every legal document, he changed his name to Alexander James Sinclair. Now, this is one of many of his aliases. At one point, Terry was called Tony Beniti, he was called Mr. Big and, like, the Australian Jackal, but in 1979, he legally changed his name to Alexander James Sinclair. But 1979 was the beginning of the end. Now we're going to start unpinning some stuff off our cork boards, okay, guys? So, in March of 1979, skeletal remains were recovered in the Port Macquarie area, which is along New South Wales' north coast. The skeleton had no hands, they had been severed off, and most of the teeth had been pulled out. This made identification very difficult. And it would be revealed that this is the body of Pommy Harry Lewis. If you remembered, Harry Lewis was the one that was arrested at Sydney Airport with 2 other couriers, skipped bail and headed north. It is believed that even though he was a middle-level courier, he tried to take a greater share of profits to compensate for the risk. And Terry didn't like that and ordered the hit on him. And I want you to remember about the fact about the hands being severed and the teeth gone. It will, unfortunately, pop up again. Now, a lot long after the discovery of Harry Lewis came the discovery of Greg Ollard and Julie Thalman's bodies. Both had died from a single gunshot to the head, execution style. The trigger was pulled by none other than Terry himself, believing that the two were liabilities and would crack under pressure if they were arrested after they tried to leave the organisation. Then, in early of April 1977, like this is all happening very, very quickly, Doug and Isabel were lured to Melbourne from Sydney under the pretense of there being a safe house, only to find that there was a hitman by the name of James Bazley waiting for them on orders from Terry Clark. James followed through with his job and executed Doug and Isabel, buried their bodies in a shallow grave in Rye, Victoria, where they were found 5 days after the fact. Now, interestingly, James did, however, spare the dog that they had taken with them. So, like, a hitman with a soft side to animals. I don't know what happened to the dog afterwards, but, like, thanks, James, for not killing the dog. I don't know how to feel about that. I should note that James was a known hitman and was suspected of the death of an anti-drugs campaigner and politician, Donald McKay. So the bodies are really starting to pile up now, and because they were all known associates to Terry, everything was pointing to him, to heroin, the drugs, the organization. Tensions were high and Terry was spiraling. And with the discovery of Doug and Isabel's body, not long after Harry, Greg and Julie's discoveries, the public were in an absolute uproar. And the police, both in Australia and New Zealand, could no longer turn a blind eye. In fact, the press caught wind of the interrogation tapes that were bought, and they were able to source a transcript almost of what was on those tapes and what Doug and Isabel had told the Brisbane police about the organisation, about the mole in the Bureau of Narcotics. An inquiry into the Bureau was announced, and very shortly after, the Commissioner of the Bureau, Harvey Bates, announced his resignation. That's suspicious. And I mean, Harvey wasn't the mole, and it was one of those save face kind of moments. You know when a company gets hit with some backlash, the top dogs usually like stand down to say, oh, you know, it's my bad, I didn't keep everyone in check. I think this was what Harvey Bates was doing. He was shortly after invited to resume his post and he stepped back into it. So he wasn't the mole, but, you know, interesting. But the media would not let any of this drop, even after the resignation of Harvey Bates. Now, usually media, they don't always help investigations. They can be really annoying, especially now. You know, a lot of media can spread false information or misinformation, and there's a really like love-hate relationship with the public and the media. However, in this instance, the media were actually doing an okay job of just reporting what they knew and what they were told and making the public aware of this drug organization. The Auckland Star journalist Pat Booth was the one to release the first huge story about this drug operation, which was extremely, extremely risky. Now, Pat had parts of the information that Doug and Isabel let on, but not everything. In fact, they actually didn't have Marty's name. They just knew that the kingpin was in Singapore. And it wasn't until late 1979, with Pat Booth's expose on the drug operation, that Marty was dubbed Mr. Asia. And this is how the drug syndicate moved from being called The Organization to the Mr. Asia Drug Syndicate. So that's where the name came in. Pat Booth was in a lot of trouble after the story broke. He would later find out that Terry placed a hit on Pat for $30,000. Pat received a phone call one night with an anonymous woman on the other end that said, quote, "You have made a serious error of judgment. Martin will not be pleased," end quote. Pat had his car tampered with, his wife and kids were put in danger, they had multiple break-ins at the home. These people were not messing about. Like, this, I don't know if I'm doing it justice because I'm kind of laughing at the idiotic things they were doing, but they were a very, very dangerous group, and you did not want to get onto their bad side. Now, fortunately, the hitman that Terry hired actually never showed up, and Pat Booth is alive to this day. And from what I like read or actually didn't read, his wife and children were never killed or injured. You know, I feel like there would be a big article about that if that happened, and I couldn't find one. So hopefully and thankfully that they're all okay. But like the mindfuck that this would give you, right? Like, oh Lord, like, having to sleep with an eye open, not being able to like feel safe in your own home. Like, these guys in this drug syndicate were just ruthless and so, so dangerous. But yes, it was in 1979 that Pat Booth coined the term Mr. Asia in reference to Marty. But now the cat is out of the bag, right? Terry is absolutely losing his shit. He's not coping with this. He's drinking way more. He's intaking way more drugs than he already is. And it's not just heroin, but a whole array of narcotics. He's gambling. He's obviously never in debt because he's got money coming out of his asshole. But he also found himself a new... I don't know if she was a powerful companion, but a new interesting companion. And this was none other than his lawyer's young clerk, Karen Soyich. After he was acquitted of the heroin charges back in 1978 and changed his name to Alexander Sinclair, he moved back to Australia with Karen in arm and in bed. Lots of times. They were lovers. Now, Terry's next thought wasn't to turn himself in, you know, with all this media attention, with everyone kind of realizing who they were and what they were doing. It wasn't to turn himself in and call in quits, but to move on to the next phase of the operation. This was to expand on an even bigger global level. He was so paranoid that he just wanted to get out of Australia, but not to stop. He wanted to conquer the US and the UK. He's got big dreams, this Terry Clark. Now, Terry and Karen Soyich would spend time lounging in pools in Beverly Hills, LA, and traveling in Cadillacs, just having a great time not being in the continent of Australasia. But Terry was also scoping out the drug scene in this much larger country. Now, even though this is 1979, as we learnt last week in our little drug history lesson, New Zealand was late to the drug game, but America, being right next to Mexico, they were already balls deep in this, and Terry wanted to find out more about it. So after this, Terry and Karen would also go to the UK. Now, we're going to put a pin in Terry and Karen. They're too busy having sex on a duvet made out of banknotes right now, so we're going to leave them to it. We will circle back, and I say that because, like, fun fact, allegedly Terry did give Karen a duvet made out of banknotes, like that he could just literally do whatever he wanted with money. But we're gonna pin it here. Now, obviously, with Terry going global, this was green-lighted by Marty. He is the boss. He's the one in Singapore with the opium warlords and sorting all that out, whatever. However, Terry was also a very heavy drug user, gambler, and playboy himself, and not everything was smooth sailing. Now, in mid to late 1979, Marty had failed on a huge drug deal and lost quite a bit of money. And things between Mr. Asia and Mr. Big weren't looking too good anymore. And this drug deal pretty much cost Marty so much more. Ooh, all right, this is it, guys. This is the climax. This is what we're here for. All right, stick with me. Near the town of Eccleston, Lancashire, in October of 1979, two amateur divers, Geoffrey Ashcroft and Ian Reading, they were exploring the murky waters of the Eccleston Delf, which was a World War II mine site that had since been flooded with water. Now, the Ecky Delf, as it is known by, it was known as the perfect spot for divers, amateur or experienced. There was diving guide ropes that had been placed to aid divers navigate the Delf. It was mainly filled with old cars and rubbish. In fact, in the year 2000, the quarry was drained, cleaned, and refilled so that it became safer. And over 250 cars were recovered. Most of them were like stolen cars that had been dumped. But in 1979, the two divers were underneath where, on a ledge 30 feet beneath the surface, they found a body wrapped up and weighted down. At first, they thought it was a mannequin, but then they realized it's not a mannequin. It's never a mannequin, okay, guys? It's never a mannequin. Geoffrey and Ian shot straight back up to the surface and called it in to the police. Now, Lancashire police immediately set out a dive squad to recover the body and found that it had been mutilated past the point of recognition. The hands had been severed off and the jaw and teeth were badly damaged. Does this sound familiar? It probably should, because that's how Harry was found, except Harry had his teeth pulled out, but we'll get around to that. Now, they couldn't get any ID off the body. Obviously, with the hands gone, there were no fingerprints. The teeth were too badly smashed or removed to get any kind of match with dental records. They got nothing. So what they did was they made a death mask, which is essentially a mold of the deceased person's face, and they circulated it throughout newspapers all over Great Britain and Northern Ireland to try and get any kind of lead on this investigation. The body was naked, however, the only piece of clothing or possible identifying feature was a blue stone medallion necklace that hung around the neck, and it was engraved with a Chinese symbol, which ironically meant long life. Within the newspapers that were circulating these images, the body was described as a powerfully built male, aged between 25 and 35, standing around 1.8 meters tall, suntanned and well kept. This meant that he had like a, you know, a neatly trimmed mustache and shoulder length brown hair. However, a few weeks passed and no one came forward. Investigators believe this to be a gangland style execution, and they spoke with their sources in different gangs, but lips remained tight. Nobody was narking. Investigators also visited shops that sold similar artifacts to the Chinese medallion, but there was no lead that came from that. The murder was dubbed the Chinese puzzle until they got their answer. An answer which came 3 weeks after the discovery of this body. On November 2nd, Julie Hugh, a former beauty queen, and her best friend Barbara Pilkington walked into Leyland Police Station and told police they knew who the body belonged to. They identified the body as Julie's missing boyfriend. Oh, are you ready for this, guys? Okay. 27-year-old Marty Johnston, the kingpin, Mr. Asia himself, had been murdered. And honestly, all I've got in my head is like, I don't even know what like year, but like 1800s, like boys on the corner street go like, extra, oh no, not 1800s, like wartime, like young boys on the corner selling newspapers like, extra, extra, read all about it. Mr. Asia himself been murdered. Even though back in those times, they probably didn't even know New Zealand existed. Like, oh my gosh, this is just, So Julie told police that while she was on holiday in Spain with her best friend Barbara, she became worried when she didn't hear from her boyfriend Marty on her 22nd birthday. He wasn't with her because he was supposedly in New York in America doing a deal. Now, Julie had described Marty as a, quote, New Zealand businessman dealing in drugs, end quote. And when she became worried that she didn't hear from him, you could see she was clearly on edge. She then heard about a body being pulled up in the UK and about the medallion, but it didn't really catch her attention. What did was that her best friend, Barbara Pilkington, who was in Spain with her for her 22nd birthday, knew that the murder was going to happen. How did she know? She's married to the person who killed Marty. Okay, so now you might be thinking, lovely listener, well, it can't be Terry who killed Marty because he's too busy shagging Karen on a literally money-made duvet. And you'd be right, that's exactly where Terry was. But the person who killed Marty was none other than Andrew Mayer, his best friend. Ah, this is why I wanted to drill it into you guys. Like, the betrayal in the story, I just can't. Andrew Mayer, the best friend, murdered Marty. This is why I wanted to drill it in into part one. They were best friends. Andrew and Marty were best friends, and now their girlfriend slash wife are best friends. And Barbara, sorry, bitch, she knew that this was going to happen to her best friend's boyfriend and said nothing till after the fact. Bitch! To make matters worse, like just to push the knife in deeper, Andrew and Barbara had a daughter, and that daughter, her name was Marty, M-A-R-T-I, named after Marty Johnston, Andrew's best friend. Like, oh my gosh, like, imagine being, you know, the daughter Marty, growing up knowing that who you're named after is the person your dad killed. Like, that's not how best friends are supposed to act, okay? Okay, I'm probably being a little bit harsh because there was reasons for Andrew to do the deed, but oh, the story is just wild, right? It's mental. So how the fuck did this happen? Well, you know that deal that Marty failed on? Well, what happened was prior to his death, obviously, Marty had flown to meet with Terry in the UK, and Terry wanted to find a new source of heroin. You know, he'd just been all over the US and the UK, and they just thought they could do better, get a better type of heroin, if that makes any kind of sense. Marty and Terry decided that $50,000 should be enough to go and make a deal and get a good new source of heroin. They worked out what profit they would make and all that kind of financial stuff, and $50,000 was the number they decided on. So then Marty went back to Pattaya in Thailand to make a deal on some new variety or this new source of heroin, but it didn't go to plan. The dealers in Thailand took $35,000 for only one bag of heroin. Now, to me, they saved money, right? They didn't spend the whole $50,000, they only spent $35,000. To me, that's a win, but like I said, I don't really know much about the drug life. But when you're in it as deep as these guys were, when you put a figure down, that's what the figure is. No higher, no lower. And Marty panicked over this $15,000 loss, essentially, because he knew that Terry was on edge. He knew he wouldn't settle for a $35,000 bag of heroin. He wanted a $50,000 bag of heroin. I don't get it. I don't want to get it. But Marty was starting to shit himself. He knew about the murders that Terry had dished out. He knew that he was on edge. He knew that this was not good. So Marty decided that he was going to bring back this $35,000 valued heroin, but he mixed it with castor sugar to try and beef it up. But Terry had already heard about this bad deal before Marty was even on the plane. Now, I think it is important to note, and just as a refresher, Terry is a bit older than Marty. So even though Marty was the boss, I think just from the age power dynamic, Marty kind of still looked to Terry for advice, and, you know, it was his right-hand man. He confided in him, he made plans with him, so even though Marty's the boss, he was still quite terrified of Terry. So before Marty had even got on the plane, Terry had already heard about the deal gone wrong. So Terry set up a plan. He'd lost his patience, his respect, and his trust in Marty, seeing him as too young and too immature to be the kingpin of such a huge organization. It didn't help that Terry was so paranoid being on all this crack cocaine and heroin and everything else that he was smoking and snorting. He decided that it would be so much better if he, Terry, was the head honcho and the only one running the show. So Terry wanted to hit Marty where it hurt, and he wanted to do it without suspicion. This is why Terry threatened Andrew Mayer into getting close to Marty. He threatened Barbara, he threatened Andrew's daughter, Marty, a lot, and Andrew was more scared of Terry than he was loyal to Marty, and that's why I said I probably was a bit harsh. His family was threatened, I get it. I think I wanted a bit of shock value, because I had shock value when I found out that Andrew was the one who killed Marty. I was like, no way, his best friend. But yeah, no, his family was threatened, and it was just a very unfortunate situation, because they all got into drugs. Just don't do drugs and you won't enter this kind of lifestyle, guys. Okay, again, don't do drugs. Now, Andrew got in contact with Marty before he was on the plane back to the UK, and Andrew had told Marty that there was a contact in Glasgow, Scotland, that would be in touch to supply him with some very good stuff. He said good stuff, some good heroin. Little quick history lesson, Scotland became Britain's heroin capital in the 1980s, so they were up and coming with this like pure medical opium smuggled out of drug factories. It made sense. It wasn't a random like, oh, why has Scotland got heroin? It made sense. Now, Marty is thinking, okay, I'm mucked up in Thailand, let me go and get some good shit from Scotland and make up for it. So Marty landed at Heathrow Airport in London on October 9th, where he was picked up by Andrew, where The plan was to drive up the country into Scotland to meet Andrew's cousin, James Smith, before meeting the supplier. However, just north of Eccleston, Lancashire, in the town of Leyland, Andrew stopped the car and shot Marty in the head twice at point-blank range. Now, where he had stopped was obviously not random, as Andrew was very quickly joined by his cousin, James, where the two men took Marty's body to a garage in Leyland. In the garage, the two men used an axe to slice off Marty's hand, and they placed a cloth over his mouth and took a hammer to his face to smash out the teeth. Now, because of the cloth, it actually didn't do a very good job of completely damaging the teeth, and it's believed that the reason James and Andy did use the cloth was because Andrew didn't want to see the face of his best friend and daughter's namesake being disfigured. The men slashed at Marty's stomach so that he wouldn't float. They wrapped him up in plastic and industrial tape, weighted him down with a lorry jack, took him to the Ecky Delf, the quarry, and dumped him. However, one of the ropes tied around Marty's body got caught on one of the diver's guide ropes in the quarry that I told you about, and essentially aimed Marty's body down towards a ledge. Now, if Andrew and James went a meter to the left, they would have missed the diver's rope altogether, and Marty's body may not have been found until the quarry was drained in the year 2000. Like, a simple meter to the left, and this whole story would be so much different. And then, 5 days later, Jerry Ashcroft and Ian Reading discovered Marty's body. I will quickly note that one of Marty's hands did actually get found in a river in Scotland. It was kind of random. They found a hand and they were able to match it up, and pathologists and everyone involved were able to say, yeah, this is Marty's hand. So one of his hands was found. I think it was the right one. They never found the left. So along with Andrew and James, there were two other men who were implicated in this plan. A man named Charlie Russell had supplied the gun used to kill Marty, and Keith Kirby supplied the weights used to weigh him down. All four men were caught very quickly after Barbara and Julie spilled everything to the police, and it also didn't take long for law enforcement to locate Terry Clark, who, at the time of his arrest, had just finished shagging Karen at a flat in Kensington, London. Like, they were literally still in bed when police came busting in through the door. What the UK authorities didn't fully realise at the time of these arrests was that they had just unravelled the whole of the Mr. Asia drug syndicate. I mean, they knew it was big, having a New Zealand businessman who dealt in drugs turn up in an English quarry. They knew it was something, but they just didn't know how big it was. I will also note that Terry was still using the name of Alexander Sinclair, and that's who police believed they arrested, not Terry Clark. That's a much bigger name. They thought they were arresting some Alexander Sinclair. So that's, again, another reason why they didn't know how big this arrest was. I will also quickly note that it was found out that Terry had put a hit out on Diamond Jim Shepherd, who was the banker. It sounded like Terry wanted a clean slate. It was never followed through, and Jim actually got word of the hit against him and decided he was going to fly over to the UK and kill Terry first. But the day before he was going to fly to the UK was the day that Terry got arrested. Diamond Jim Shepherd is still alive to this day, and in fact, most of what we know from this case is from Jim Shepherd, because in the most recent years he's released books and done interviews and brought the entire story out. I just wanted to put that in there before we go on to wrap up this case. Terry was planning on taking everyone out because of paranoia, because of wanting to start again, but yeah. Alright, so the five men, that was Andrew, Terry under the name of Alex, Charlie, Keith and James, they were brought before the magistrate's court in Chorley in May of 1980, but the trial didn't begin until 1981. Now, this trial would be one of the most expensive and heavily guarded proceedings in British history. The Liverpool Echo, where the trial was held, was described as a, quote, siege fortress, end quote, with more than £100,000 being spent on security. That would be roughly $679,482 New Zealand dollars today. Sorry, American listeners, I'm keeping it New Zealand. This is a New Zealand case, I'm very sorry. It was a lot of money, okay? It was a lot of money. Now, like I just mentioned, Terry was referred to as Alexander Sinclair throughout the entire trial because that's what all of his papers said. That's what people read, that's what people saw. However, prosecutors in the UK and Australasia were like 99.9% sure that this was Terry, or Mr. Big. That's who they were looking for. They had Mr. Asia, he was murdered, now they're looking for Mr. Big. But they just actually couldn't prove it, because like I said, Terry had changed his name on everything. But the prosecutors within the trial were making it a point to the jurors of how much they believed that Alexander Sinclair was Mr. Big, or Terry Clark. And I will just add that the reason why Terry and all that weren't extradited back to Australia or New Zealand for any of the drug stuff was because, one, again, they couldn't prove that this was Terry, but two, the trial was solely for the murder which happened in the UK. The drug operation did come up, and Alison Dine, if you remember, we talked about her being, you know, the top courier for Terry and one of his lovers and the kindergarten teacher. Well, she was actually subpoenaed to the Liverpool Echo to testify against Terry / Alexander Sinclair. Now, it came out in court that Andrew was acting under Terry's orders when he killed Marty because he was given a kill or be killed ultimatum, but he did plead guilty to the charges. Terry maintained his innocence the entire time. He said that he was, quote, no lily white angel, end quote, but he was not guilty of the crime. This is another reason why they had brought over Alison Dine and a few others to testify against him, just to show that, yeah, okay, you may not have been the one to pull the trigger, but you are a manipulative bastard who organised this whole thing. On July 15th, 1981, 123 days after the trial began, James Smith, Keith Kirby and Charlie Russell were all handed life sentences for their part that they played in Marty's murder. Now, interestingly, or I don't know if all the articles and stuff that I read were right, it seemed that Terry and Andy were actually given lighter sentences. They were each given life sentences with a 20-year recommendation, whereas like the others, it just said they were given a life sentence with no years of recommendation. And if I've understood this right, the whole years of recommendation, I mean, Dom and Amy from Horror House Podcast will have to correct me, but I understand this as like the non-parole period of being 20 years, but then they can apply to be released after that. Whereas, like I said, the other men were just given life sentences. So it seemed that Andrew and Terry actually did get lighter sentences, which I believe to be very interesting. Andrew Mayer ended up serving 30 years in prison, and he died at the age of 58 behind bars in 2011. I mean, I know I was rough on him, and, you know, again, it was the shock value of being the best friend killing the best friend, but I actually do feel kind of bad that he died in prison. I think it's because I know he has a daughter out there, and his family was threatened, and now they've been kind of torn apart because of him being in prison. I don't know. It's a hard spot. Just like I said earlier, don't get into drugs and it won't become an option, like, in my opinion. It's my advice. Thanks for coming to my TED Talk. Now, I'm not sure what happened to the other three, Charlie, Keith, and James, but Terry. Ooh, Terry. Terry was serving his sentence at HM Prison Parkhurst on the Isle of Wight when in 1983, 2 years into his life sentence, he died. The ruling of Terry's death was a heart attack, but even to this day, there are rumours that he was murdered. Some believe that Terry was the victim of a hit that was ordered from the IRA after Terry claimed to be involved with the IRA in a drug deal, and some suggest that he actually tried to escape prison and was given a dose of a drug that invoked a heart attack. The IRA theory seems to be the most popular one from the associates that are still alive today that were involved with the Mr. Asia drug syndicate. So that, my lovely listeners, concludes the story of the Mr. Asia drug syndicate. Oh my goodness, what a case. This was super fun for me to research, and, you know, that fun in like a true crime way, because like I said in the intro of part one, it has all sorts of true crime material in here. It's got drugs, it's got kingpins, it's got murder, it's got serial killer, it's got betrayal, it's got corruption. It covers all bases, right? It also allowed me to learn about the history of the country that I live in. You know, like, it was super fun to research, and I really hope that you guys enjoyed this two-part series. I do want to say before I wrap up that unfortunately, the impact of the syndicate is still seen to this day. The amount of people living with hepatitis C from sharing instruments and other lifelong illnesses came from this world of drugs that Marty and Terry not started as much, but blew up in the continent of Australasia. The syndicate did start what is known as the silent epidemic because people didn't know they had contracted hep C or anything like that until much later in life. Drugs are still very much a part of society, and addiction is an illness that we do need to talk more about. There are resources available out there for help, and if you know anyone battling with addiction, please guide them to these resources. They have to take the first step, but sometimes they need a hand to hold while taking this step. don't give up on them, but also don't do drugs, period. But if you're already in that world of drugs, whatever your situation, whatever the scenario may be, please look after yourselves, please be safe, please educate yourselves about the drugs that you're taking, where you're getting them from, anything like that, and just try your best to be safe about it and wean yourself off them so that nobody is dying from drug overdoses or getting involved in the drug life, which, as we've seen, especially in terms of Andrew Mayer, he had a wife and child, and he had to do the unimaginable. He had to kill his best friend because of the world of drugs. So yeah, it's a hard one. This is what I love about true crime and the true crime genre. It allows conversations to be had that people don't want to have. Let's talk about addiction. Let's talk about ways that we can help each other out, or if you know anyone battling with addiction, it needs to stop being seen as something shameful. These people need help, and us as community, as whānau, family, friends, we need to be there to help them, and we need to be able to have an open conversation with someone who we believe is battling with addiction. So that's all I'm going to say on the matter. Please use any resources that are available out there and talk to someone and do your best to be safe if you are in a situation where drugs is prevalent in your life. So that is all from me, lovely listeners. Thank you for sticking with me with the change in schedule, but we will be back on track from next week. I can't wait for next week's episode, guys. It is a doozy. You can get in touch with me on Facebook or Instagram at Coffee and Crime Podcast with thoughts, feelings, or recommendations. I want them. Give them to me. Recommend a case to me, please. I'd love to do a shout out. I'd love to interact with you guys. And I've got a few already lined up, but I want more. Give me some recommendations. But until next time, be safe, be good, be better, and all that cheesy crap. And I'll catch you guys next time right here at Coffee and Crime. Bye.